Texas Crescent Rising. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Samori Maxman, Manager of Programming here at WBAI-FM. Please join us on Friday, June 26th at 8 a.m. for our monthly Report to the Listener. We'll talk about the new economics and our survival on the citadel of capital, Wall Street. We'll talk about some new programming steps, we'll review some old programs, and look at how and where we intend to go over the next year and a half as we mark our 40th anniversary. Again, this Friday at 8 a.m., for a Report to the Listener here on WBAI, listener sponsored Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM in New York.
Do you know that the U.S. Space Command has plans to fight in outer space? If you want to protest the militarization of outer space, come to a demonstration this Wednesday, June 24th at noon. We will meet at the Isaiah Wall across from the UN on 43rd Street and learn about NASA's plans to send more plutonium missions into space. Speakers include Michio Kaku, Ernest Sternglass, Harvey Wasserman, and Carl Grossman. So come join us on June 24th, which is exactly 1 year before the Cassini flyby. For more information, call Tina Bell at 212-533-2125. That's 533-2125. This has been a public service announcement for WBAI on behalf of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and Physicians for Social Responsibility.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI in New York, taking you into the space age. Now it's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. I couldn't get my sweat.
Good evening to everybody. It's another edition of Off the Hook. It's a program about technology, hackers, high tech, Big Brother, and the future. And we've had a very exciting week. We've been talking about the future of the Kevin Mitnick movie and various other things that have been going on in the past, a couple of weeks on that front, past 3.5 years on the Kevin Mitnick front. And the important news that we have is that, yes, our efforts have paid off, and we do have a copy of the script. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight on Off the Hook. Stay tuned.
The horses are on the track.
Going around when the hits start flying. Yeah.
are on the track. They've been doing it down at the zoo, and I can show you.
And it has indeed been an eventful week for us here. The script is right here in our hands. We've got Phil and Porkchop here with us this evening. Good evening, gentlemen. Perusing the takedown script here. Let's just go through a couple of things as far as what we have to look forward to. You know, when I first heard about this thing, I said, you know, a film is a film. People should be able to make whatever they want to make, but we should have some say in it. I don't believe this anymore. I mean, I read this thing, and it is so bad. It is so awful. It is so, I guess, what's the best word for it? Libelous? Defamatory? Inflammatory? This is horrible. This is as bad as it could possibly be, and that's far worse than I thought it could be. Let me tell you who's going to be portrayed in this film. Kevin David Mitnick, of course, they use his full name, Tsutomu Shimomura. Kevin Mitnick cast by Skeet Ulrich, Tsutomu Shimomura cast by Russell Wong. Then we have Louis DePayne, who is a friend of Kevin's, who has also been indicted, but he is not in prison. That's a big difference there. Described in the casting sheet as an early admirer of Kevin David Mitnick, cyberspace's most wanted hacker. He holds him in reverential esteem, calling the computer crimes that landed Mitnick in jail at 15 elegant. Having hacked his way into Mitnick's sphere after Mitnick gets out on parole, he becomes Mitnick's closest and only friend. Not what you'd call a sentimentalist. Smart, knowledgeable, but also humble and admiring. Then you have Julia Menapace. Remember her? She's the one that Tsutomu Shimomura stole from John Gilmore. There's a whole big thing about that. In her mid-20s, thin, she's Shimomura's girlfriend, who also works with him at the computer center at the University of California at San Diego. Very bright, not overly demonstrative. She's quite upfront about her feelings towards Shimomura and seeks to reassure him that her former relationship with a rival of his is over, even though she's still living in his house. Very knowledgeable, in fact. Shimomura is living in his house, too. That somehow is glossed over, that whole bit there. Very knowledgeable about what Shimomura does. She becomes very concerned over Shimomura's obsession with finding Mitnick and grows angry when he persists in the dangerous hunt. What is so dangerous about flying to North Carolina to hunt down a hacker? I mean, well, actually, I can answer that based on the film. I can answer it based on the film. There is some physical danger involved, which has no bearing on real life. Then we have the FBI special agent, LeVard Burns. These are all real names, too. This FBI special agent, obviously considered a person of weight in the Bureau, is the superior to Agents Carson and Ornelas, and is working on the Mitnick case. Very cordial and polite to Shimomura, who, after all, has provided him with most of his information. He nevertheless makes it clear
that this isn't about computer security anymore. This is law enforcement. And he wants Shimomura to back off. Concerned that any breach of bureau etiquette will send Mitnick flying to a high-powered lawyer, Burns is unfailingly polite to the relentless Shimomura, but ultimately the day is his, and he and his people are the ones to physically detain Mitnick. Yeah, for over 3.5 years. Andrew, Shimomura's assistant at the University of California at San Diego's Computer Center, he's in on the first investigations into the mysterious hacker, most likely FBI's most wanted, Mitnick, who's breached the high-tech security in Shimomura's computers. Hardworking, very bright, and rather sarcastic. They don't make him look like a dummy like Shimomura did in his book. So I guess they talked to him, and he worked out a deal. Carson, a female FBI agent. Carson is a very efficient woman. Assigned to find Mitnick, she first approaches Shimomura, but doesn't get much help from him, winding up frustrated when the elusive Mitnick always stays one step ahead of her and her partner, Ornelius. Ornelius or Ornelis? Spelled two different ways. Eventually, Carson and Ornelius retreat from FBI company policy and, following orders, refuse to retreat behind FBI company policy and, following orders, refuse to involve Shimomura anymore in the trail as it winds down. Ultimately, they're the ones who arrest Mitnick. Then you got, now he's Ornelis again. An FBI agent, Ornelis, is rumpled, has a lopsided grin, and is fighting a battle with his waistline. Yeah, assigned to find Mitnick, he first approaches Shimomura, but don't get much help from, okay, from him, I guess it says here. This, keep in mind, this has been Xeroxed about 45,000 times. Not complaining, it's just kind of hard to read here. The elusive Mitnick always stays one step ahead of him as well, and his partner Carson. Eventually, Ornelis and Carson retreat behind FBI company policy once again, and following orders, blah, blah, blah. Okay, then we have a waitress, name of Karen. This waitress at a university coffee shop in Seattle is knowledgeable, particularly about Italian espresso. That's witty. No, that's humor. That's the kind of thing people pay money to see, that kind of humor. Particularly about Italian espresso. Very nice. Smart and intrigued by Mitnick, whom she waits on, they begin dating, but something's not quite right about him for Karen, who keeps seeing him, but keeps her distance. She brushes him off for good, however, when he tries to introduce her to scanning, listening in on other people's phone calls, which she dismisses as kind of cool, but also kind of creepy. Oh, boy. Then we get Jim Murphy, known affectionately as Murph, an operator at the high-tech Sprint switching office. He somewhat cautiously agrees to work with Shimomura and Andrew, even though they don't have a search warrant as yet. Very informative and knowledgeable. Then we have Nevin Pazaski and Todd Young. These are the Cellular One people. These two high-tech fraud analysts based in a Seattle cell phone company work on a series of clone mobile phone calls, netting upwards of $10,000. Nevin Pazaski is in his early 30s. Short brown hair, glasses. His partner, Todd Young, described as a cyberspace bounty hunter, is also early 30s. Humorless. All business. Yeah. Then we have Pai Chin, technical consultant at The Well. She's a young Asian-American woman who noticed some anomalies during a routine maintenance check of the system. Friendly and outgoing, she explains that she not only found email addressed to Shimomura, which she read, but other inactive accounts loaded with information only a hacker could have retrieved and placed, clearly the work of Mitnick. John Gilmore, the big cheese at The Well. He's about 50, and though the top is thinning, the ponytail is straight back. Previously romantically involved with Julia, he never mentions her name when Shimomura comes to San Francisco to track Mitnick, but he's overtly hostile and unhelpful to Shimomura, very much in charge. He seems to resent the fact that, I'm not sure if that's the right word I'm reading here, that he will not consider any of Shimomura's suggestions, claiming his responsibilities to his users as his reason. In other words, he jeopardizes the whole investigation because he's got a grudge against Shimomura. Yeah, okay. Then we have Robert Hood, who works for Netcom and leads Shimomura through a maze of computer workstations and the machine room. He understands exactly the sort of anomalies Shimomura is looking for, and eventually narrows the field down to Raleigh-Durham. Then we have a committee chairman of Congress. This man heads the congressional hearing on the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1994 and questions his star witness, Shimomura. And we have a kid who plays Kevin when he's 12 years old. That's how the film opens, actually. It opens with Kevin, 12 years old, playing pinball and cheating. Yes, cheating, using foul language and cheating and holding a magnet up and getting all these points and getting the number one score, just to sort of, you know, set you up with the character of Mitnick. Well, guys, you've had a chance to thumb through this. I've got some more detailed analysis of this, but what's your first opinion of this kind of thing right here?
It sounds like a really bad 80s movie, like something that you'd have the Brat Pack in or something with these types of characters. But also, you know, it's making him out to be a supervillain, and he certainly isn't a supervillain at all. Most films, if you try to think back, like War Games or, you know, the movie Hackers or whatever, has these benevolent kind people. I mean, it'd be nice even if he was portrayed that way.
This film is going to make Hackers look like Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
You know, it's just unbelievable.
I don't even think Kevin played pinball.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, that's something. They obviously did their research. You know, here's the thing. They didn't talk to anybody. They didn't talk to any of these people. How are they able to make a film with people's real names who have not been convicted of a crime, you know, and say what the crime is? You know, they make up things. I just don't understand how they can do this.
It doesn't even seem like it's based on the, you know, inaccurate takedown book as well. They took their creative liberties
They took the story from Takedown, and they, I guess, elaborated on it. They basically took the book and made a script out of it, and did some real liberties as far as you know, the truth goes. Porkchop, your views.
Well, it's several times removed from reality. You have reality, then you have the writers of the book, you have the book, and then you have this script. And the script is too far removed from the reality to really have any real, true facts come out. And this is what the public will believe, unfortunately, if this movie is made and made the way it's portrayed in the script.
See, I would have no problem if the names were all different. Then it would just be another bad film. But the difference here is that they're using real people and making it seem as if this is what really happened. You know, it's just, I mean, how would you feel if you woke up one day and you saw a film that showed you, your name, your town, your street, and showed you doing all these horrible things? You'd be kind of upset, wouldn't you? You know, and that's what we're facing here. That's what Kevin Mitnick cannot defend himself in prison. He's, you know, at a big disadvantage. And I think they're taking advantage of that fact that he can't, you know, object to this thing. Although I will say, as of tomorrow, he will have a copy of the script. And hey, if we broke the law by sending him a copy of a script about him, then come and get us. You know where we are. This is you know, this has gone on too far. You push people enough, eventually something's going to snap. And you know what? Something snapped. This is enough. This is too much. And things are going to happen now. We're going to start some definite drives to keep this thing from moving forward. I mean, this has got nothing to do with the creative process anymore. This has to do with spreading lies and ruining people's lives. And Miramax, Dimension Films, they are going to be made aware of this fact very, very clearly, and as will the rest of the media. Let's have a couple more observations here. We remember when the front page article came out, July 4th, 1994, front page New York Times, article about Kevin Mitnick being on the run, eluding the federal authorities for over a year. The kind of thing that really isn't good if you're on the run, because all of a sudden everybody will be looking for you. Well, they portray that article coming out in this film. They portray Kevin being upset at it, but not upset at the fact that the article is there and that his picture's on the front page. Upset because the article is below the fold. Yeah, below the, you know, if you look at the New York Times, there's a top and there's a bottom, you know, because it folds. And he wanted to be on the top of page one, not the bottom of page one. That's the kind of person they're turning him into. Someone who is, just cares about his image. He needs his friends, like Louis DePayne, you know, who is a real friend of his, to constantly tell him that he's the best. You know, you're the best there is. And, you know, one of the lines, DePayne just shakes his head in full awe. That's who Mitnick is supposed to be. Kevin likens his fate to a game of Pac-Man. There's food. You find it. You eat it. You stay alive. Then there's a couple of ghosts chasing you. They find you. You die. That's it. Oh, boy. What kind of a person is this? Also, another weird part about this, apparently Kevin never heard of Shimomura until the Fed started to use him to capture hackers. You know, he just all of a sudden heard about this person through a newspaper article, never heard of him before. And that's, of course, contrary to the way it was in real life. Shimomura was kind of famous in the community. A lot of people knew about him.
Didn't he do some questionable things as well?
Well, you know,
from what I recall,
throughout the whole film, there's this sort of mood that Shimomura did something questionable in his past for Los Alamos National Labs, and they throw this whole twist into the film, which was not in the book and certainly not in real life, that Shimomura had to get to Kevin's data before Kevin released it to the world because it was something that Shimomura had to prevent from getting out. You know, so you have this other sense of urgency. And in the end, and you know, if anybody is really looking forward to seeing this film, if it's ever made, and doesn't want the ending ruined, turn away now, because we're going to ruin the ending for you. In fact, we're going to ruin the whole damn film for you, because, you know, it deserves to be ruined. In the end, what happens is Kevin is desperately trying to upload this secret data to the world from the apartment complex in North Carolina as the feds are closing in on him. Not only does he do that, he messes around with medical records, you know, just for the fun of it. Yeah, the feds are across the street. They're going to come. They're going to capture me. But I'm going to mess around with somebody's hospital records. That's the kind of person I am. So as he's uploading the data, unbeknownst to him, he's really connected to Shimomura. So he thinks he's uploading to like Netcom or something, but Shimomura is using an FDDI concentrator to fool him into thinking he was connected to another system. And Mitnick is defeated that way, and apparently Shimomura captures the data that he was trying to keep from getting out there. So yes, Shimomura was involved in something in the past. Something he was ashamed of, something that he never should have gotten involved in. But it's never said just what that is. Also, in the beginning of the film, this is crazy. Kevin hacks a radio contest to win a television set for him and Louis DePayne, who are living together at that point. He's in a department store, and he uses a cellular phone somehow to call in a radio show, and you hear his voice over all the speakers in the store. And what's really amazing about this is that it's done so badly that he answers the phone. The phone rings, he answers it, and gives the winning phrase for the radio station. And then they call him the lucky caller. You know, how can you be the lucky caller if they called you? You know, you're not the caller then. You know, that's the way this thing is written. Then you have Shimomura up in front of Congress being what appears to be insulted by some racist guy who insinuates that he's going to tell the Japanese all these secrets simply because he's a Japanese-American. And, of course, that gives you sympathy towards Shimomura, saying this poor guy has to battle this kind of thing. And on top of that, Mitnick is portrayed as a racist, anti-Japanese person who's always talking about Pearl Harbor and horrible things like that. Refers to Shimomura as Jap Boy. Things that have no basis in reality, and they just keep hammering you with this, so you wind up really hating Mitnick and really feeling sorry for Shimomura, even though when you look at his actions, they're pretty far from honorable. That's the problem I have with the film overall, though. There really isn't anybody that you like that much. I think the guy from Sprint I like, but he only had about three lines. But everybody else, just... no, there's nothing appealing about them. Then maybe they'll fix that. Maybe they'll make it, you know, so that somebody has more character. But the facts are still totally wrong and horrible. Shimomura doesn't become obsessed with Mitnick until Mitnick insults his girlfriend. And that's when things go too far. That's when he has to really, you know, get involved. And what's also weird is that they make it seem as if Mitnick hacks Shimomura's machine, and then all of a sudden everyone's looking for Mitnick. They don't go into any of the detail as to why Mitnick was already on the run about the probation violation whether or not that really happened, just how minor this whole thing is. And I think that's interesting that they didn't do that, because obviously there's no story there. There's no story in what happened to start this whole thing. You know, he had a minor probation violation, which was questionable, to say the least. And he was also accused of associating with certain people. I mean, how do you make a, you know, somebody who's evil out of that? It's so minor. It's so incredibly minor. So they had to make it as if he was doing something really bad, which, again, doesn't even come off as being really bad, because all he did was log into a computer system and insult somebody's girlfriend. But that all of a sudden makes him into this cyber monster. At one point, Shimomura says to Julia, "I didn't mean to bring you into this. I should never have brought you into this." You know, and again, this is over-dramatization. There's nothing that was really brought into anything. It's just someone logged into your computer system and copied some of your files, and you learned a lesson about security, but it seems to go much further than that. You guys find any interesting bits of dialogue there?
I found an interesting section about Mitnick being chased by a Rottweiler while running away from the...
Yeah, the Rottweiler scene.
Yeah. There's the two agents...
You know, you can't use the word that he uses to describe the...
Yes, I do.
You can use one of the words, but you can't use the other word. Okay.
Well,
Mitnick is a foul-mouthed creature, according to this film.
They're in a Kinko's, and the two agents receive a fax. Mitnick sees the fax from the California Department of Motor Vehicles to Special Agent Stanley Arnalysis, however you pronounce that.
Whatever that name is, yeah.
Mitnick grabs the fax, turns around, only to find Carson and Arnalysis on the other side of the counter. "I think that's addressed to me." Mitnick smiles weakly, and then with an athleticism we've never seen before, bolts out the back door. Arnalysis and Carson in close pursuit. Bum, bum, bum. They run out the parking lot, blah, 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 blah. They go through a couple of suburban homes, and he drops the ground, hops over a fence, drops to the ground, and freezes. What he sees, not more than 40 feet away, staring right at him, a big, mean-looking Rottweiler, wow, growling.
Wow, your hearts are like in your mouth at this point.
Mitnick says, O-S dash dash dash. Abruptly, the Rottweiler charges. Mitnick scampers back. The dog is fast. It almost is on top of him when, snap! The dog runs out of line, yelps in pain, straining against his collar. It's inches away from Mitnick, and Mitnick says, that's right, you F-dash-dash-dashing Nazi.
He called the dog a Nazi.
The dog begins to bark loud, skipping a couple lines to go through a couple more places, and later you see the Rottweiler charging, ragged, the torn leash dangling behind.
He broke the leash.
Mitnick is almost over some fence, I think, again, when the dog jumps high, comma, unbelievably high. This this script is written, I don't know.
The script was written in a night, I think. Or it was written by a machine or something. I'm not quite sure how they got away with this. It gets far worse. I mean, I'm saving the best for last, or the worst for last, or whatever. There's a section where Mitnick cards plaintiff. Now, keep in mind, this is somebody who's never been accused of stealing a penny, but in the film, he cards plane tickets for Louis DePayne to follow Shimomura to his presentation so that he could heckle him. All right, this is what hackers do. You know, they buy plane tickets for each other so they can go and heckle their victims. So an audience member is asking Shimomura, what did they get from his computer system when it was hacked? And Shimomura says, that's confidential. Louis DePayne pipes up, not anymore. And, of course, the audience laughs. Shimomura gets all upset because he realizes that there are Mitnick sympathizers in the crowd. And then he says to the voice, where's Mitnick right now? And Louis DePayne says, that's confidential. Shimomura retorts, not for long. Yeah. Now, they also say, and this is great, this is just amazing, Shimomura, in order to figure out Mitnick's trick, sorted ones and zeros by hand. Sorted ones and zeros by hand. I want to see how they portray that, and just what it is there. They're trying to.
It's like an elaborate card trick or something.
This is one devoted person here. Sorted ones and zeros, but it must be some Japanese trick or something. Oh boy, the federal agents are made to look like so helpless and endearing. You know, this one agent has like their lights and gas turned off, and they're trying to make a cup of tea. You know, so you feel so sorry for them because they want go to the water and they pour water. They try to turn on the tap, nothing comes out. So they go to the refrigerator and they get bottled water and they put that in the cup and then they put it on the oven, and then your heart breaks when they turn on the oven and it doesn't go on. And the cup of tea just never materializes. They have to order out or something. And you know, Mitnick is cackling in the background someplace as he's just turned off their water and gas. And
phones are out, you can't order out.
It turns off the phones, everything.
So they might have to walk down somewhere and get something to eat.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Despite the fact that this never happened in the first place, you know, there's that to consider. More Shimomura ego-boosting with this little bit of dialogue in exchange with an investigator. And how do you come to have access to classified material, Shimomura says. I wrote it. Boy, this is one hero that we're building up here. Okay, and you ready for this? Kevin Mitnick whistles touch tones to avoid depositing money in payphones. Whistles touch tones. Touch tones. Now, just so people are aware of where the touch tone is. Yeah, listen to this. All right. Okay, there's a dial tone. That's a touch tone. How many people do you know who can whistle that, you know? It's going to be kind of difficult because they're two different tones, you know? It's sort of impossible. But this part I kind of want in the film. I want to see how they do that. Mitnick whistles touch tones to avoid depositing money in payphones. They're implying that he uses a red box, I guess, which he doesn't ever do anyway. But regardless, they're going to do that in the film.
I'd like to see that red box confiscated.
Well, it's not a red box because he does it with his mouth.
The voice right. box.
Yeah. In fact, the last line of the film, I can give away the last line. In the film, Shimomura comes to visit him in prison. First of all, he's already sentenced. They somehow jump ahead into the future, and they have this guy, Judge Dixon, finding Kevin guilty of felony theft of intellectual and real property in violation of Section 6 of the Penal Code, as well as violation of the terms of his previous parole. The two sentences which aren't defined are to run consecutively, and I doubt very much it would be anything near 3 years, 3.5 years, whatever it will be by the time he gets out, or by the time he even goes to trial. They try to totally change Shimomura's image at the end to somebody who's trying to be friendly to Mitnick. Now, if you recall, when the two met for the first time in North Carolina, Shimomura was completely hostile to Mitnick. Mitnick went up to him and said, "I respect your skills," and I think all he got out of Shimomura was just a casual nod or something like that. But that was it, and that's it in real life. But in the film, in the courtroom, quote, Shimomura tries and fails to catch Mitnick's eye. Shimomura visits Kevin in prison and says he's sorry it had to be like this. And as for breaking into Shimomura's system, he says to Kevin, "Good work." I mean, if I was Shimomura, I'd be upset at this. But I guess the check he got from these people probably makes up for that. So, as we told you before, the FDDI concentrator was what defeated Mitnick and made him upload the secret file to Shimomura. Shimomura says to him, "Your technique, my implementation." And that's when Mitnick says, "I admire your skills." And as Mitnick is taken away, he says to Shimomura, "I'll be seeing you. All I need is a dime and a phone. Sometimes, if I'm lucky, I don't even need the dime." And that's how the film ends. That kind of weirdness right there. In Kevin Mitnick's apartment, the modem sound is deafening. Well, of course, all of us who use modems know that there's a constant shriek of modem noise that we can't ever seem to turn off that follows us around everywhere. For those of you interested in getting involved in computers, don't, because you'll lose your hearing because of all that modem noise that always is there. Yeah. If someone out there, by the way, can figure out how to turn off the modem, you know, the modem noise, all of us in the hacker world would just love to know how to do that.
I can't get that ATN S3, I think it is, out of my init string.
No. What else do we have here? People listening to the sound of touch tone, the sound of touch tone dialing over the cellular scanner. Which, of course, if you ever listen to a cellular phone call on a scanner, you don't hear the touch tone dialing. That doesn't make any sense. But that's just the kind of stuff you'd expect to see in a film. Also, hokey dialogue, like, you know, people in airplanes talking to each other who are having relationship problems, you know, and the phone starts to cut out. I'm losing you. We're breaking up. Things like that that really will bring tears to your eyes, but not for the reasons they wanted. No detail is given on how Shimomura stole Julia away from John Gilmore, but John Gilmore is portrayed as bitter, potentially dangerous, and he jeopardizes the investigation to settle the score, refusing to help out and track down the hacker. The people at the well management, are portrayed as idiotic deadheads who protect unauthorized users. At one point they say, we can't erase the sensitive data that the intruder uploaded because that would be a violation of our agreement with the users, where we protect their words. And you know, I doubt any such conversation ever happened, because obviously an intruder is not a user and they can do whatever they need to do to get rid of what he put up there. So that's just insanity. I think the people at the well would be pretty upset at that too. I think deadheads would be upset at that, and I think Electronic Frontier Foundation, they'd be upset too, even though they haven't really said anything about this. Electronic Frontier Foundation, actually they call it Electronic Freedom Foundation, I don't know what that means, but people in that organization were helping to capture Mitnick, according to this film, and that's really not the kind of image I think they'd want to have. Meanwhile, the feds are constantly worried about Kevin Mitnick outmaneuvering them in court. You know, they are seen as the victims, not only having their power and you know, water and gas turned off, but, you know, basically Kevin will outmaneuver them in court. They say at one point, he won't be on trial, we will. Thing is, he's not on trial, he's never been on trial, and they're trying to keep him from being on trial for as long as possible. And I think it's about time that they indeed were put on trial for this. Let's see, what else? It just goes on forever. I mean, there's all this idiocy in here, and it really makes you mad reading the script. At one point, Shimomura says that, you know, we have to move faster. He could be going into medical records. He could be killing people, and we're just standing here. Okay, and I said I'd save the best part for last, so that's what I'm going to do. Here's the best part. And our phone number is 212-209-2900 in case people have some points they want to raise, questions they want to ask, because we have the whole thing right here in front of us. This is the sound of garbage. So I'm hitting the table. It's right here. So if you have any questions about it, we'll be happy to answer it. And we have to talk about what we're going to do about this, too, and how we're going to stop this thing. Here's the best part. Kevin Mitnick, now keep in mind Mitnick and Shimomura have met once in a courtroom, and Mitnick said one word, one line to Shimomura, and Shimomura nodded to him. That is it. That's all that has happened. In the film, Mitnick clubs Shimomura on the head with the top of a metal garbage can in Seattle. Here's a quote. Shimomura, dazed, blood flowing freely from a gash above his ear, raises himself to his elbows and watches Mitnick disappear into the night. Unquote. Shimomura winds up having to get 9 stitches and a neck brace. What kind of image do you think that might give of Kevin Mitnick and of Shimomura? Totally, totally fictitious. A lie. A real miscarriage of truth and justice. And I don't know, guys. What do you think we should do about this?
Well, that's one of the good things, is people can do something about this. And after listening to all this, I'm sure there's a lot of people at home who are very upset. And some of the things they can do are all contained on Kevin Mitnick's site, www.kevinmitnick.com. And they can go there and read the history, the true history, or we like to think the true history, based on a non-biased point of view.
Well, a lot of court documents, which certainly that's about as real as you can get.
Yeah, those
exact transcripts.
His defense fund, they can contribute to. They can write to their senator. Mm-hmm. They can write to their congressman. They can contact news agencies, and they can get on the mailing list, which has a lot of activity right now, and see and hear the latest on what's going on.
We've had a fundraising effort from 2600 with the free Kevin bumper stickers, and I'm happy to say that since that came out about 3 weeks ago, we've raised $750 for them, and that also means that we've given out 750 bumper stickers to those people that pledged for that, and
been turning up all over.
Yeah, they have been. And, you know, it's really amazing. I was driving yesterday out on the island, and somebody beeped at me, and they asked me, you know, is that sticker on the back, is that Kevin Mitnick? They knew who it was. And, of course, they wanted a sticker, and they're popping up everywhere. There was an incident at SummerCon a couple of weeks ago in Atlanta where somebody, it wasn't me because I found out about this only last week, but somebody who was at SummerCon had stuck a sticker up near the CNN Center. You know, they just stuck it there. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to walk around the block or walk around the mall and come back and take a picture of it sort of nonchalantly, like they had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time it took them to walk around with the camera, this little kid with his mother was there, and the little kid was trying to peel the sticker off. And the guy was like, "What are you doing? Don't peel that off. I want to take a picture of it." He's like, "Well, I want you know the sticker because I know who Kevin Mitnick is." It's a little kid. It couldn't have been more than like 8 or 9. And somehow he knows who Kevin Mitnick is. And he knows that Free Kevin is all about that. So, yeah, it's working. It's getting out there. And people are being affected by this. And if you want to help, the best way to help is to spread the word. Get some of the stickers. If you're on the web, grab the image from the KevinMitnick.com site, which also has the link to that site, and put it on your webpage. Convince your friends, convince your coworkers or whoever to put the sticker up on their page as well. And by all means, get the real ones too. Help Kevin out with his defense fund. As far as the film, okay, we've got a lot of work ahead of us this summer. This thing is set to begin filming in about a month in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm sure it'll be filming in California as well, and who knows where else. We're going to need all kinds of people to help out as far as getting the word out to the people at Miramax. It's being made by Dimension Films and Miramax, and they need to be made aware that this film is a travesty, and it will hurt a lot of people in very bad ways if it's made, because they are defaming all these individuals for no apparent reason. Even like John Gotti films, you know, they didn't seem to portray them in that bad a light compared to this. You know, and those are people who have already been convicted and are infamous. This is relatively minor compared to that kind of a thing, yet they're being completely, their character's being completely destroyed. How can anybody honestly say that Kevin Mitnick will get a fair trial after this film comes out? You know, it's impossible. It won't happen. And even if he does get a fair trial, people are not going to remember who Kevin Mitnick is. They're going to remember who the guy in this film is. And they're going to assume that's who the same person is. So we have a lot of work to do. We have to get down to North Carolina. We have to get out to California. We have to contact the people involved in making this film, including the actors. And I think that's a very important thing to do. If I was an actor and I was portraying somebody, I'd want to know that the portrayal of the person I'm playing is completely wrong and completely harmful to, you know, to justice and to truth. You know, it's the kind of thing that I think, you know, some actors at least care about. And directors should want to make a film that's accurate. I mean, these are real names. We're not talking about fiction here. We're talking about something that is based on reality. You know, it's a simple concept. If you're making a film based on reality, then it should be based on reality. Not just the names, not just who wound up in prison and who wound up with, you know, a book contract. But you want to get the characterization right. And also, there has to be some mention, some showing of what the consequences of all this were. The fact that somebody has been in prison now for 3.5 years, the fact that you know, that this person is not allowed a bail hearing, not allowed visitors. Now, a lot of people don't know this. Because he's in the Metropolitan Detention Center, which is a pretrial place to be held, he's not allowed visitors. Doesn't matter that he's been in pretrial conditions for 3.5 years. It's, you know, he's in a place where you're not supposed to be held more than a year, and he's been there for 3.5. So it's these are all things that need to be brought up in a big way.
Also, he can't even take a look at the evidence against him.
9.75 gigs?
Yeah, we're actually working. I'm trying to figure it out on paper later, maybe even a computer or whatever. If he were to try to read 9.75 gigs worth of information from now until a set trial date, he'd have to read, you know, thousands of pages per second. Or whatever it is.
And the trial date has now been set for January of 1999. So we're talking about 4 years in prison before he even goes to trial. So it's sick. It really is, you know, you have to draw a line someplace. And we've already drawn the line with the whole, you know, trial nonsense and being held in prison, but this film is just, you know, we're drawing a lot more lines now. It's insane. How much can you take? You know? And while I'm happy we were able to get a copy of the script to Kevin, I'm afraid of what he's going to do when he sees this, because this is like your worst nightmare coming true. It really is. But it might be enough to wake people up and get a lot of us motivated to actually do something. Similar to what happened with Bernie S. when you know, he got the crap beaten out of him in prison. That got people mad. Maybe this will get people mad too. And maybe we can, you know, show that we can do something constructive here and affect this project in a positive way. All right, let's take some phone calls. You're listening to Off the Hook. Manuel Goldstein here with Webmaster Phil and Real Audio Czar Porkchop. I assume we're going on Real Audio tonight.
Yes, we are.
Even though you're here and not monitoring the situation.
There are several servers still active, and we should have capacity for a couple hundred people.
Okay, and it's especially important in these days as the events we're talking about take on bigger and bigger dimensions. This is going to really be a breathtaking summer, I think. You know, we'll be moving really fast, doing a lot of different things. Every week is going to be something major until this whole thing happens one way or another. All right, let's see if we can take some phone calls. Good evening, you're on Off the Hook.
Hi. I'm surprised I didn't hear that guy who always calls, who's always the first caller.
Yeah, well, sometimes there's a God, you know.
That film. Are there, like, do you know who the actors are or anything, or you pretty much have the script?
Well, two actors have been cast so far. Skeet Ulrich is going to be playing Kevin Mitnick, and Russell Wong is going to be playing Tomo Shimomura. That's
who
all.
Are these people?
Well, Skeet Ulrich was in, what film was he in?
He was in As Good As It Gets, I believe.
Okay. And Russell Wong was in The Joy Luck Club.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they're not major, major actors.
Yeah.
And I don't know who else, you know, probably Penn Jillette's going to be in this thing, too. He always winds up in everything.
Oh, my goodness. But, well, if he's in it, then that should be an ally right there, shouldn't it?
I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, when money is involved,
yeah,
when Hollywood is involved, people do weird things.
This is true.
That's what I've noticed.
Yeah.
So
oh.
We might have to approach this from a different angle.
Well, thank you for sharing about it.
Hey, thanks for being interested. What part of the country are you in?
I'm in New York.
New York,
Brooklyn.
That's a good part to be in.
Well, actually, I was thinking everyone else in the country must be listening to this show, because I can't access a thing online.
Uh-huh.
I can't get on the net at all.
Oh, really? Well, it's not our fault, is it?
It could be.
Uh-huh. Are you trying to connect and you're not able to connect?
No, I can't get any, you know, like any websites or anything.
Okay, so hopefully it's just you and not us.
Bye.
We'll keep our fingers crossed. Thanks. Thanks for calling. And let's take some more phone calls. 212-209-2900. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi, Manuel.
Hi. How you doing? Make it quick.
All right. Well, I just wanted to mention, you know, you're talking about the film companies. I make a lot of deliveries to film companies like Miramax and all of them.
Well, Miramax is the film company we're talking about, so okay.
I wonder if I can maybe, you know, get to know to the person who's, you know, involved in this, and maybe I can help out. I don't know.
Well, if you showed up at their office door, I think that would definitely carry a message. I'm not quite sure what the message would be, but you might actually be serving a very useful purpose here. I have to think about this.
How can they make a film? They didn't ask Kevin, like you said, they didn't ask Kevin Mitnick's permission.
Right.
And how could they make a film using the real names and everything? Isn't that like copyright infringement?
Well, what I imagine they're going to fall back on is that it's been in the news. And these names are a public domain, and they can be used because stories have been written about them. But, you know, the whole thing is so self-serving, because you have John Markoff, New York Times reporter, who wrote the front page article in the Times and then sold the rights to the book and made all this money at it. And now the film is being made based on the book, which is able to be made because there was a newspaper story written about it in the first place. And, you know, interestingly enough, John Markoff's name is mentioned, I think, once in the whole film. They don't mention the fact that he was there at the time of Kevin's arrest, that he helped track him down, this being a reporter who's supposed to, you know, not help law enforcement people out, you know, tracking down wanted fugitives. And they leave out the fact that he made all this money doing this and that Kevin has not made a dime and never will. That's just one other element to this.
I notice at the end of movies there's a thing that says, the characters portrayed in this motion picture are fictitious, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that is, I mean, I don't know what that means.
I think they're going to say in this case that it's based on reality, you know, but that some events were made up for the sake of drama. But this is not acceptable because this is a case that is still going on. And to portray somebody as violent, who has never been violent in his life, you know, it's just so wrong. You know, I can't say it any other way. I'm at a loss for words.
Well, I'm back from California.
Okay, well, that's, that just caps my week. But
I also wanted to mention there's lots of COCOT, New York City COCOT films.
Okay, well, you're going to talk about the COCOTs next time because we have to talk about this film this time. Let's go to another phone call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Thank you. I've been trying to get this to you for a couple of weeks. I think the last thing you want to do is stop the film.
Well, you know, I would agree with you a week ago, but
yeah,
after having read the script,
I hear you.
Having read the script, this film cannot be made in this state because if it's made in this state, it's just so defamatory, so insulting, so harmful to everybody that's involved. I mean, yeah, make a film like this with fictitious characters if you want. It'll just be a bad film.
No, but I know what you're saying also about the public domain, but I think what has to be done very quickly is that you copyright a treatment, like a one-paragraph treatment, that you copyright it, and then you're prepared, you have to be prepared to proceed from there. The names are public domain, true, but I'm fascinated enough with it to try to find you the right person to work with, because I know, I mean, don't you just have this sense that this cannot be done legally without his permission? But I think it's important to do something that is your best vehicle for getting the story out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could speak with Miramax on the grounds that Kevin won't sue you if you allow him to have the final say or director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to something to the effect of that. And I have to explore the terminology more, but the idea would be that he'd like to work with you, you know, and that he won't sue or press charges for personal libel or slander or whatever. You know.
Well, I'm sure he'd like to work with him, but, you know, he's been given terms, offers by the federal government that he can look at the evidence as long as he never talks about his case, and that I think would be a violation of this. He's kind of, you know, in a very bad place right now where he's not in a position to really help anybody with their projects.
He'll have to just give power of attorney to someone who knows the scope of it the best. But I'd like to somehow, investigate a little bit more on this myself, because I'm just convinced that it can't go like it is, of course, but that I think it's your best vehicle for getting this out worldwide.
Well, yeah, I agree with that, because there will be a lot of publicity, and if we are there demonstrating against this kind of thing and getting the same amount of publicity for the Free Kevin campaign, then we have accomplished something. But it has to be lasting. It can't be something that's just there when they're shooting the film and then the film comes out and everybody believes it. You know, it has to be something that lasts. We want is to have the truth represented in the film.
Right.
You know, what has happened to Kevin and what is happening right now and people trying to get him released and how long this nightmare has been going on. He's not this happy-go-lucky guy going around whistling touchstones in prison making free phone calls. That's not true.
No, of course not.
You know, he's suffering in there every day. He's been suffering for over 3.5 years, actually, almost 3.5 years.
And the two lead actors,
mm-hmm.
I think the best way to approach it is to go to get their reps, their agents, and make sure they understand what's really going on with this person that's in prison. The lead actors might have no clue about the whole thing.
Probably they don't.
And I really believe that, because there's a couple of guys from the Rat Pack when I was doing Scenic Art, Rat Pack, and the Scenic Art in Los Angeles, that, you know, Andrew McCarthy and Rob Lowe Jr., those guys, you know, they're just so into their Beverly Hills and acting, you know, their acting careers that they don't really keep up with the current events, but I found them to be real people talking, you know, once you could speak with them about the real portrayal of the Less Than Zero was the film I was talking about, they changed their whole attitude and decided to show they did not want to promote drug use in the film. And the way that it had been written earlier,
mm-hmm.
they didn't really care so much, and it really changed because they got interested.
You can change the message of a film. I mean, Hasidic community in Brooklyn did that to a film that was being made there that portrayed their community and what they saw as inaccurate and insulting light. They got it to change, and I don't see why we should be any different.
Right.
When something like this is coming out, why we shouldn't move forward and get it to change.
Right. I agree.
Thanks very much for calling.
Let's see if I can help somehow. Okay, thanks.
Okay, take care. Yes, everybody will be able to help. We'll give out a couple of email addresses and phone numbers and things like that, and we can start organizing and getting together and figuring out just what we're going to do next. We'll do that in about a minute or so, a couple of minutes. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, can I have some of what that last caller was smoking?
Don't know. What would that be?
I don't know, but it seemed like it was pretty potent stuff. If she thought that movie in its present state or anywhere near its present state would be anywhere close to be good.
Yeah. Well, what would you recommend doing?
Well, first of all, how can they keep... What's the guy, Jackoff? The reporter. What's his name?
You know, it's funny you should call him that, because that is what he's referred to in the film by Markov. By Mitnick.
Oh.
And, yeah, that's the one mention he gets, actually.
Hmm. But he was a major player in the whole story.
A very major player. He wrote the story, and he played out the story, and he helped capture Kevin. And none of that is focused on at all. And, it, you know, for a very good reason, too, because if you focused on that, people would say, hey, wait a minute, why is this film being made when the whole thing has been contrived by people who profited from it?
Yeah, he was almost like a puppeteer.
Uh-huh. Almost, yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, a writer for the New York Times really should not be doing things like that.
And then making this whole profit off the book.
Uh-huh.
Seems to be a trend.
And the screenplay and God knows what else, the action figures that are coming out of this film.
He's in on the screenplay too?
Well, I mean, he wrote the book with Shimomura and obviously sold the rights to the screenplay, so they made a tidy sum from that, I'm sure.
Who wrote the screenplay?
Who wrote the screenplay? What's the name?
Howard Rodman.
Any dirt on him?
Well, not yet, but we just got this thing, so...
Yeah, the last name's a little suspicious, if you ask me.
Well,
yeah.
We'll have to look into it. We'll have to look into it, and this is one person that will be contacted, and we will attempt to talk reason.
All right, keep up the good work, guys.
Nice, thanks very much for calling, and we'll be in touch with everybody who's interested in helping out. See if we can squeeze in one more phone call. Good evening, you're on the air.
Oh, great, I'm the last phone call. Quick question on another subject.
Make it quick.
They had a picture of you in the New York Times.
That may very well be.
You didn't see it.
I think I might have.
Oh, that I
it was a scary looking one.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. It was so unflattering, and you had a T-shirt on that said Satan or something like that.
Well, yeah, you know, people wear shirts that say different things on them, and fortunately, this is one of the ones that could be photographed. So,
oh my goodness.
I don't think it was that bad looking though.
Well, no, it wasn't that. You were bad looking, but it was just that the whole context made you look kind of demonish.
Well, they wanted me to be demonish. They wanted me to scare people.
Oh, well, why didn't you not wear that shirt?
Well, I wanted to make them happy. I wanted to make them happy and scare people. You know, that's okay. It sells papers. The same paper, by the way, the New York Times. Maybe I shouldn't have listened. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just needed to verify that.
Okay,
okay,
but
thanks.
Don't worry. We won't hurt anybody.
Okay.
All right. Yes. Oh, what a nice note to end on. Okay, well, now, if people want to get involved with the Mitnick campaign, they can email us here at Off the Hook, oth@2600.com. You can also join the Kevin Mitnick mailing list, which is where we're discussing what we're going to be doing next. Obviously, you need internet access for these things, but if you don't have it, we'll give you other ways to get involved. To join the Mitnick mailing list, first of all, you can just go to the www.2600.com site, look in the Mitnick section there, which is about to be linked over to the kevinmitnick.com site, and you can get it all there as well. But if you just want to subscribe now, send email to majordomo, M-A-J-O-R-D-O-M-O, @2600.com, and on the first line of the message, simply type subscribe Mitnick, M-I-T-N-I-C-K, and put that in, not in the title, in the first line of the message. And that will subscribe you to the mailing list, and instructions on how to post will follow. If you simply want to call us and get involved that way, 516-751-2600, extension 0 is the best way to leave us a message with whatever it is you feel you can do to help. And if you don't have a phone and don't have a computer and you just want to write to us at 2600 P.O. Box 752, Middle Island, New York, 11953. We're at the beginning of a very interesting campaign, and it's going to take us to some very weird places. So the best way to keep abreast of the situation is to stay tuned to this radio show, Off the Hook, every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Phil Porchop, thanks so much for coming in, and I guess we'll be hearing from you in weeks to come.
Yes, indeed.
All right, and we'll keep you updated as to the progress or regression of this film. Till then, this is Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. Have a good night.